Hello, Radio Cochimbona listeners. I am so excited to be unlocking this lit review from the second season of Radio Cochimbona's Lit Review. On this lit review, I had a friend of the podcast, Laura Barrera, a fellow Latina, who is now an assistant professor at The Ohio State University Law School, join me to chat about The Yellow House, a memoir by Sarah Broom. We break down how Broom unveils New Orleans East and the ways in which it has been historically neglected, especially as compared to the French Quarter of New Orleans. We also broke down how the slew of New Orleans mayors have tried to make the city better and shared how we relate to Broom's intergenerational storytelling and how our stories do not begin and end with us. The Lit Review is a special segment that I do for patrons, and as you see now, I also occasionally unlock them so that we can all share in the good times and good conversations. But The Lit Review is a book club style chat with fierce women of color, and it's one of my favorite things about doing the podcast. So if you want to hear more episodes like these, please feel free to go to patreon.com/radiocachimbona and become a patron to support the work. You can also follow at Radio Cochimbona on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. I hope you all enjoy this unlocked lit review. Hello, everyone. Okay, wow, that was like the fifth time I tried that. I'm really excited today to have Laura Barrera, who is a fellow immigration attorney. She actually does deportation defense for detained minors. And she was on the Lit Review when we read Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston. And now we're back because we read the memoir The Yellow House by Sarah Broom. And the book is focused on her house that she grew up in, but it also tells the story of the generation before her and all of her 11 brothers and sisters. And it's been really popular. A lot of people have said that they feel like she has changed the genre of memoir and has brought in other genres into it. We were talking about how she has kind of some journalistic elements with how she identifies people in her family by their first names instead of the names that she knows them by, but only in certain parts. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, so you're the one who suggested this book to me, actually, because we were going to do it for a book club, which might happen TBD. So why did you, like, what drew you to the book?
So I think I was actually reading the list of nominees for the National Book Award, mm-hmm. and I've been trying to read books by women of color, mm-hmm. and I thought this book, I mean, it just sounded really interesting, and so that's why I wanted to read it. Basically, I'd heard really good things, and I personally have been trying to focus a lot my reading list on reading books by women of color.
Yeah. And it's set in New Orleans, and I appreciated reading this after having recently visited New Orleans in August. Because the neighborhood that she grew up in is called New Orleans East, and it's a historically neglected part of the city, and actually so much so that she points out in the beginning of the book that on maps of New Orleans, the city, it doesn't even actually show up a lot of times, mm-hmm. because the French Quarter predominates, and New Orleans East is so much bigger than the French Quarter that if it were to be on a map, it would look like the French Quarter is this tiny part of New Orleans, when kind of to the larger U.S., New Orleans is this romanticized Mardi Gras, beads, alcohol, party all the time. And she kind of unpacks that and talks about how that's really not true. How
Have you been to New Orleans?
I was there once for the AILA conference. Oh. But it did actually, it made me think a little bit.
Did you also stay in the French Quarter?
I did, yeah, because the conference was in the French Quarter.
I know. I went to New Orleans for a conference. It was in the French Quarter, so I only stayed in the French Quarter.
But. It made me think a little bit in some of her descriptions about Detroit. That's where I went to law school, and that's where my mom's from, and it's kind of similar. Like, I think people think of Detroit really as, I mean, I guess unlike New Orleans, most people don't have a very romantic vision of Detroit. But if people do go there, they really stay in like a very small space that is downtown and midtown. And most people really don't live in those places, and they're very neglected. But the city still plays up the image of Detroit, kind of uses the experience of the people who live outside of downtown as like people, like, are hustlers. They know how to work hard, and because there's a brand actually called Detroit Hustles Harder, that's what I was thinking of. Oh. And people like are very hard workers and can get through anything, but then the city doesn't actually like support those people, but they kind of just use that image. And then like the actual city, as far as what gets supported by the government, local government, is like a really small area that doesn't really represent the population at all.
Mm-hmm. Also, isn't there a lot of, there's been a lot of foreclosures in Detroit, especially after the mortgage crisis in 2008, right?
Oh, yeah. Especially after there was water shutoffs, and, like, they were taking, there's all kinds of issues with, like, water pipes breaking and leaking underground, and people getting water bills that were, like, $1,000.
Oh, my God.
And couldn't pay them, and they used that to put a lien on the house and then take the house and then sell it. Actually, they talk about that after the, yeah, in this book.
That's
yeah, they did that.
Yeah, because I think both Detroit and New Orleans have a parallel in that they're both, at least at one point in time, had very large black populations, and mm-hmm. also the local government and state government, in the case of Detroit, like, really neglected mm-hmm. the city and neglected its poorest residents, who were black folks. And so she talks about Katrina and the devastation that it did to the houses in New Orleans East, and how there's this really wild supposed project for restoration of homes, but it was, and they called it the, oh my God, what is it called?
The road?
Road homes?
They're calling it road homes.
Yeah, I think they're called road homes. Maybe that was the program that it was, but basically, for people whose properties have been damaged, they were given a few options. You could be given money to renovate it, or you could sell it, and both ways were kind of, it was a catch-22 for people, because like renovating it would have been more expensive than what the city was offering them to do that. And then the payout that they were getting was based on current market prices after Katrina, where everything was devastated, so they weren't getting paid really what the house was worth before Katrina.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one thing that was really cool about this book. What you said about how people have been saying that she kind of changed what it means to be a memoir. Mm-hmm. Because I think she was a journalist by career, right? But in reading this book, you don't just learn about her life, but you learn a lot of facts about New Orleans, both like historically and more present day, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, that's true. That's why I appreciated reading it, because it was kind of, it was a historical account of the city of New Orleans, like investment and disinvestment, and also the different politicians that have been mayor and like tried to fix the city and failed. Mm-hmm. So to talk more about how we think that she blended genres with this book, how else did you see her doing that? Like, something that you wouldn't have normally seen in a memoir.
I think normally in a memoir, we think of someone talking about themselves, right? About their mm-hmm. life. And that she really, there's a lot of parts of this book that aren't about her.
Yeah.
So, like, it starts with her talking about, I think she starts talking about her grandmother's generation. Mm-hmm. Or I don't recall if it was even her great-grandmother.
I think it was her grandmother's generation. Like, she might have mentioned her grandma's mom.
Yeah, so like that she starts there, she talks a lot about them, and she talks then about her mother and her upbringing and her siblings and her parents. And then there's other parts where she talks a lot about the history of the city. And so, unlike kind of a more traditional memoir. There's just big parts of this book that are not about the author.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we brought up before we started recording too is that, like you mentioned, she was a journalist by trade, and there's some parts of it that do feel journalistic. It took me a while to figure out who her father was or what his name was, because sometimes she would say my father, but then sometimes she would say Simon Broom. And she did that with all her family members. Like sometimes she would call them by their nickname, and then sometimes she would call them by like their proper name or like their government name. And also, yeah. And I guess memoirs are usually introspective, right? Because I felt like she was just doing a lot of really deep reflecting.
Yeah.
Even in how she organized the book. The sections are The World Before Me. Wait, I wrote it down because I was like, this is cool. The first section is The World Before Me, and then the second part is The Grieving House. In The World Before Me, that's where she talks about her grandparents and her mom and her siblings. And then The Grieving House is where she talks about her dad's death.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also kind of before her, because her dad died when she was 6 months old. And so I thought that was one of the more touching parts of the story too, that like she was reconstructing her dad's life, even though she had never really spent significant amount of time with him through this memoir.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really beautiful. And then the third part of the book is Water. That's where she talks about Katrina. And then she wraps it up with, you know what it means, investigations. And that's where she takes you through this kind of meta explanation of the book, how it started, what she did to write it. Yeah, and I feel like the memoirs I remember reading when I was middle school, I feel like were just like chronological life.
Yeah, that's true.
Life tellings.
Yeah.
But I thought it was cool that she divided up her life thematically.
Right, it's almost like more similar to just like a nonfiction book that you would read rather than like a memoir.
Yeah. So what did you think about how she started off with the map of New Orleans, and like what does it mean that New Orleans East isn't on the map? Do we think about who creates maps and what authority that creates?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it says a lot about what the perceived center of something is,
mm-hmm.
Because I'm sure probably the French Quarter isn't really the center of New Orleans.
Yeah.
But in any map you would look at, they almost think of it as that's all that needs to be on the map, because you wouldn't ever be looking for anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it does say a lot about which communities are erased and which are considered important, and then also, when you think about...
And, like, representative of the city, like you were talking about.
Yeah, like, when you think about who makes the maps and mm-hmm. how much that says about what powerful people think is important.
Yeah. I'm reminded of how, like, historically, globes were made so that Europe was looked larger than it actually is. That's what her focus on the map and like, talking about how New Orleans East isn't even on the map reminded me of, that because I feel like with GPS we kind of take the creation of maps for granted and just assume that it's a subjective activity, and it's actually not.
Yeah, definitely. Have you ever seen those like pictures of like people have asked like random Americans to like name countries and like other continents, and it's just terrible. Like nobody has any idea what anything is.
Yeah. I've seen those a lot, and I feel like since Trump, I'm sure that those videos have just increased, because I think there was always kind of this like, haha, Americans are ignorant thing, but now it's like really...
Yeah. I think it's like, I hope that people think it's less funny now, because it actually has consequences.
Americans think it's less funny?
I hope.
Yeah. I know, I always found it kind of sad.
Yeah, it's definitely sad. But I feel like it used to be...
Well, I'm sure that, I mean, there's people that... I think this is when we get to nationalism, but people think about American exceptionalism and think mm-hmm. that the U.S. is the best ever, and we don't need to think about other countries. We don't need to know about other countries because they're irrelevant. That reminds me, oh my God, there was these Yale fraternity boys who would wear these shirts that were like America, like World War champs, like back, is it back to back World War champs?
Wow.
Yeah. Thank you. Oh, so we were talking about how much we learned about New Orleans through her telling of her story. I also thought it was cool that her dad played for Doc Pollen, who's like this famous jazz musician in New Orleans. And she said that Doc Pollen offered, he was so close to her dad that he offered to throw a jazz funeral for him, and then her mom was just so stressed that she said no. Mm-hmm. And then Sarah, also I think it's, okay, I'm about to get into the ceremony thing later, but I thought it was interesting that she said, I also regretted that my mom didn't do that because I felt like a part of my own narrative was taken away.
Yeah.
Because she said that she felt like she inherited her musicality from her dad. And that passage was just an example of, like, this woman is so deep and so brilliant. I don't know. She intertwines so much when she's actually just talking about herself, which I feel like is something only a woman of color could do, a black woman could do, because mm-hmm. white men are the centers of their own universes.
Yes, absolutely.
And like, they're the protagonist, and life is like, everybody sees life through their eyes.
Yeah.
And it's just so amazing how she's able to bring in family, intergenerational trauma, music, narrative, identity in one book. And like, and for me, it was like in that one paragraph too.
Yeah, I think it's actually really hard to contextualize yourself.
We all tend,
maybe especially white men, but I think we all tend a little bit to want to think like we are our own story.
Yeah, well, it's how we experience the world, so it makes sense.
Yeah. But there is this, and of course in some ways that's true, but there is this broader context in which it makes more sense. Really, it is kind of incredible about this book, how she really does think through the whole context of her life. And she does so much of this making connections between all the things that she did in her life and how that relates to this like bigger scheme of everything that the generations that came before her did and her siblings.
Yeah. So this is something I wanted to ask you about. She talks about meeting Samantha Powers, the UN woman, UN diplomat, I don't know. And how she was at this dinner and it was like posh and they were like networking, and she said that she really wanted to do some traveling because she wanted to, post Katrina as a New Orleans person, she wanted to see something along the lines of quote unquote globally how people are dealing with loss and displacement. And it sounded like something that a person would write in a personal statement to get into school, or like something you would write in a book. Or like something you would write in a bio. And I love those little parts where she's kind of taking a jab at herself. She's kind of critiquing herself, but also just being very real about how navigating professional spaces, this is, especially like when you're directly impacted or adjacent to an issue, you have to navigate things in a weird way. And I thought that was actually like, it was, I think she was probably critiquing herself, but I think also it's just very real. Like, I've definitely done some dumb shit like that too. So I just wanted to ask, have you had that experience? What did you think of her writing about that and reflecting on that?
Yeah, I think I could definitely see myself. Like, I could, it made me imagine myself at that age. Mm-hmm. Also, because I think that was like early 20s.
Really?
I think it was like early 20s.
Okay. Interesting. I hadn't really thought about how old she was when she was an adult.
Yeah, I mean,
she was very impressive at that point. Like, she had worked for Oprah.
Yeah,
the magazine. And then, what did she do?
Didn't she go to Burundi after that?
So then she was at the magazine.
Yeah, I think she was at the O magazine.
And then she quit.
I think.
And then she was looking for Burundi. And then Burundi was like her April love.
When I was
very intense
younger, I was also really, I think I did have all these sort of impressive sounding philosophical reasons that like I wanted to do things.
Yeah.
Especially kind of similar to her, like get away from where I was.
Yeah.
I think I also felt that, and felt, because there is a lot of guilt that comes with that too. Mm-hmm. And like feeling like if you can justify it, if you can be like, oh, this makes sense for my narrative.
Right.
There's a really good reason I'm doing this.
Yeah.
Then
there's a really good reason I'm like leaving the country and not talking to my family for a long time.
Then you like can feel like it just feels justified, like you feel like you need to justify it. And so it definitely made me think about just kind of being at that point in my life also, like kind of early to mid 20s. I guess I'm not that much older than that right now, but I think I'm starting to come out of that phase.
No, I mean, I know. I sometimes feel a little silly because I'm 27 and like someone was asking me about the historic wine. I was like, oh, it's near 4th Avenue, like where the college kids hang out.
I know.
Bitch, you were there 5 years ago.
I don't know if you can say that yet. I was just saying that to someone. I'm like, I feel so old here. It's a college town. And they're like, are you even 30?
Are you?
No. Almost. So I'm getting close.
I'm getting close. Yeah, I was telling my boss that, like, I feel like I relate to over 30 Twitter too much.
Yeah.
Because I'm only 27, I shouldn't be relating that much.
No, that's real, though.
They're talking about backaches, I was like, oh, my God, yes.
I have that, too. Like, I have a pinched nerve in my back right now.
Oh, my God, that's serious.
I know.
Okay. The author also talks about how she's kind of Sarah in her professional life and Monique to her family. And you were talking about the guilt that's associated with leaving your nuclear family, especially if you're really tight with your family. And I feel like this happens a lot in Latinx households too, where parents are like, oh my God, I want you to live next door forever. And one of the things that she brings up is that one of her brothers, like, to like tease her, make fun of her, would be like, Sarah, and she'd be like, why are you calling me that?
Yeah.
And I think for her, it was she felt stung because that her brother was questioning her role in the family or how that role might have changed because of her college experience and like where she had gone. So I wanted to ask, like, if you are professionally one name and like another identity or name with your family, or if like you can relate to that general idea of like having to navigate these different spaces and these worlds that never meet.
I think like as far as names, not as much, but at work it is like Laura in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And other times actually like Laura other times, but sometimes also Laura, so like whatever works. But I do feel that sometimes when I'm maybe going to talk in a presentation or something like that, I will actually have to be like, what should I say? And have to change it. But I think also, I don't know that I had such a defined place in my family growing up as she did. She talks about it a lot. She was the baby girl. Like everyone, she was the youngest of all these 11 kids. And so she's like baby girl. Everyone's like protecting of her. And like, I don't know that I like felt so, like I didn't fit so neatly where I grew up with my family even. But I do think that moving away and sort of, I think she talks, it's kind of like in her story as well, like moving away to a bigger city and
becoming, she moves to New York.
Yes, becoming a professional. And then how when you go home, maybe that doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel that sometimes. Like sometimes I'm really like, I become very aware of coming off maybe really bougie or like, you know, does that happen to you too?
Well, yeah, I think my mom has a little bit of a chip on her shoulder because it's kind of funny that we would get to this point because she came to this country because she wanted me to have an education. But I think now sometimes she just, and maybe it's things that I do and say that I need to reflect on why I make her feel that way, but she feels, I don't know, she gets defensive a lot, and I feel like she maybe sometimes I feel like her reaction to me is based on the assumption that I think that I'm better than her because I'm college educated. And that just breaks my heart because I don't feel that way at all. Like, I think I really related to her being like, I'm not Sarah, I'm still Monique. Like, I don't know why you're trying to say that I'm a different person now. Especially because I've tried really hard to not let these institutions and it's a, you know, white dominated workplace culture change the essence of who I am. And so it's really hard to see how, even if you are trying hard not to have your essence change, the way that people interact with you changes it, like, once you have a degree, I found.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think my sister is the one who kind of does that to me the most.
Mm-hmm.
She will, I think sometimes she tries to make my niece, who's very young, like, think that I'm, like, that I think I'm really important or something. like, on the one hand, I think she likes that I'm, like, a lawyer, and that's a good example for her daughter, but at the same time, it's sort of, oh, but also Aunt Laura moved away and, like, has this important job.
It's, like, a little bit resentful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And sometimes I do feel like I'm not actually any different.
Right, right.
But maybe I am, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, I feel like I kind of had to reflect on that when, during my third year of law school, I moved to West Oakland, which at the time was at the very early stages of gentrification, and I was 1,000% participating in that. And I, like, hadn't thought it was going to be as problematic as it was, because I'm from the Bay Area, and I was moving in with my Latina roommates and friends from Yale. And then it's like, actually, at the end of the day, like, the fact that we went, I don't know, it was just a wake-up call for all of us, because it's like, you know, we see ourselves in a certain way, especially being on a campus like Yale and being first-gen and low-income and Latina women. I think, felt marginalized in that context and then forgot to readjust when we moved.
Right, yeah.
And then it's like, I just realized, like, actually, Yvette, like, you're not an Oakland native. You were born in Pacifica, predominantly white town. And your neighbors don't care that you're first-gen low-income, because all that they see is your Yale hoodie, and they think that you're not, they know that you're not from around here. But yeah, that was something I had to go through.
Yeah, that is, actually, I had a kind of similar experience, because when I went to law school, I moved to Detroit. And then my mom's from Detroit, and they grew up in not a great area of Detroit. And my my ex is also from Detroit, and he's mixed race, and also I'm Latina. And I think, we also had that kind of, we had that conversation. We were like, are we part of, like, before we moved, you know, we're like, are we part of the problem or not? You know, and it's like it is sort of a confusing thing.
Yeah.
Because you're like, we have connections to the community, and we're maybe not as ignorant or, like, rude as, like, some of the other people.
Yeah.
But then it is, like, later you're like, actually, though, we are contributing to rising rent costs and all these other things. You're still part of that, even if you don't fit the, like, typical description of the people moving in and gentrifying the neighborhood.
Yeah, for me, I just had to kind of be honest about my lifestyle, because West Oakland at the time was single family homes and, like, these really bougie coffee shops that were literally selling, like, mochas for $7 or, like, $8, something absurd.
I actually went, the only time in Oakland, I was in this part of Oakland where some people were like, oh, I don't know, you feel safe staying there? And then I looked for this closest coffee shop, and I forget what it was, but it was selling, like, toast. Like, and I this is, like, before the avocado toast thing was, like, really popular. And I was like, what are toasts? Like, I was like, is it literally just toast with something on it? And, like then it was. There was, like, really thick pieces of toast with, like, Nutella or, like, avocado. And it was, like, $7 or something like that. Mm-hmm. I was like, what is this? Mm-hmm. But times have changed.
Yeah, now you can find that in Tucson, right? Too. I know. And then, like, I went to that coffee shop. And that coffee shop was obviously catering to me. And I went there because the first day we moved in, we didn't have Wi-Fi installed, and I needed Wi-Fi because I needed to check my email. And it's like, that's when I was like, okay, I'm accepting that this is who I am. Like, I am a working professional. I have a quote-unquote white-collar job. Despite the way that I grew up and despite the way that I felt navigating these institutions, I have attained a privilege that I need to be more cognizant of.
Yeah, absolutely. I had to go for work once to, like, near McAllen, Texas. And my family lives right on the other side of the border there. And so I went to stay with them. And I felt like I had a deadline. And so, like, I told them I had a deadline, but, like, I felt like such an asshole that I was like, is this who I am? Like, I'm like, I don't get to see them very much, and they're having, like, a carne asada for me. Mm-hmm. Which, like, I wasn't on my phone during that. But a lot of the other parts of the time I was staying with them, like, I was on my, like, laptop because I had this deadline. I had to file something online, and I felt the same way. I was like, I feel so just, like, gross that this is, like, but I have to. Mm-hmm. And it did feel like I am this person. Like, maybe I, you know?
Yeah. I just think we have to own it, because otherwise then I and my children, if I decide to have offspring, are going to become, like, the second-gen Latinx people at college that I went with, that really annoyed the shit out of me because they were really unaware of the privileges that they'd had growing up.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, yeah, I get that you're Latina, but also, like, your dad went to Yale.
Right, yeah.
All right. So,
does that make you think, like, did you think anything about that in the part where towards the end of the book, Sarah talks about her moving to the French Quarter for a year?
Yeah.
I think she does kind of do that thing where she, like, explains sort of necessity of living in the French Quarter to do research, and is there a part of her that growing up in New Orleans East always was, like, the place to live is the French Quarter? And
yeah. I can definitely see that because I had that same kind of romanticization of San Francisco growing up in a suburb of it. And I was able to actually live in San Francisco for a very brief period of time, from like 2014 to 2015. And I was so proud of the apartment that I had. And, like, yeah, I mean, I just thought it was really cool. So I could see her thinking that way when I read about her going back to the French Quarter. Because at that point, did she go back to the French Quarter when she was working for the mayor?
No. She was, I don't think it was in the French Quarter. She was in, I don't think it was New Orleans East, but it wasn't the French Quarter. It was when she was, like, really gonna write. She was really gonna focus on writing a book.
Oh, when she moved to the French Quarter.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I, like, reading that part of the book, I just kind of really appreciated her brother, Carl. Because Carl lived in New Orleans and, like, only stayed in New Orleans East and, like, maybe went to the French Quarter because he had to work, but otherwise he hated going. And
yeah.
She talks about how he hated going, how he, like, he was like, there's so much going on here, it's so crowded. And he would repeatedly say something like, you know, like, the French Quarter's not for everybody.
Yeah.
And I just kind of appreciate, I just really respect a person who knows what will make them happy in life and, like, pursue that unapologetically.
Yeah.
And, like, don't try and do more or less than what they want to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt of Carl's character. You know, I think sometimes it's, like, to his own detriment when he didn't leave New Orleans during Katrina.
During Katrina,
like,
yeah.
Sometimes you really do need to leave the place that you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
But in general, I really respected that. And I think I saw a lot of myself in Sarah and, like, want to be more like Carl in my future.
I agree, because, like, I think, yeah, I mentioned my sister earlier. She's, like, kind of the only one who, like, calls me out for, like, thinking I'm actually made me think of, like, in, like, I was still an undergrad, and we were having beers at a, like, brewery in Ann Arbor, and my sister posted this picture of me on Facebook where I was outside on my cell phone, like, a flip phone, I think, and, like, like, wearing some dress, and it was, like, my business lady sister, and I was, like, I think I was still an undergrad, but she was just, like, you know, she just always was, like, kind of trolling me in that way, because she is, like, much more like, this is who I am. And I think, like, I really struggled with feelings of, like, shame growing up because of where we grew up and because of who we were, you know, and she didn't have that. And I do actually, I do think about her as something, she has a lot of qualities I aspire to, or, like, to just be okay with who you are, be like, just be, like, even, like, chill about it. I feel like I'm just so always, like, so guarded and, like, you know, like, always trying to be something more.
Yeah. Well, you're just talking about how, like, you feel like you need a 5-year plan.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm, like, I'm always, like, what can I do that's more, that's gonna be,
like,
really better?
Like, I went to law school.
Yeah.
And I'm, like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what my next goal is.
And she's,
I don't know. You can just live your life.
She's much more, she's much more, like, what can I do to be more happy?
Right,
yeah, like, she just, like, has much better goals than me.
So, something we talked about before recording, too, was how she, in the first part of the book, she does outline her mother's generation, their sibling dynamic, and, like, their mother and the parenting that they experienced. Did you like that part of it? Because I did like it, even though, like you said, it was kind of confusing to keep track of everyone's names, because it reminded me of this other thing I heard somebody say where they were talking about white people and they were like, I feel so sorry for them, or like, I feel so sorry for somebody that thinks that their story begins and ends with them. Mm-hmm. Like, they were like, in order to tell my story, I have to talk about my parents, and that's very much how I feel.
Yeah.
I can't explain to you why I'm living in Tucson doing detained deportation defense without talking about my parents and their journey to the U.S. So I found it so appropriate that, and I was like, wow, like, I really respect that she's going back and, like, reconstructing through the archives.
Yeah.
That generation. It made me want to do that, too.
Yeah.
Talk to my grandma and record her stories. How did you feel about it overall? Because I know you said that, like, it took you a minute to get into the book for that reason.
It did, yeah. I think, like, probably, like, the first 60 pages or so, like...
This is a big book, also.
Yeah, it's almost 400 pages. I think it's, like, 370.
Yeah.
And they're big pages.
The text is small.
Yeah, exactly. There's some pictures, though. I think, like, it was good. I never wanted to, like, stop reading the book. But definitely the first, like, 60 pages or so, I almost felt like I needed to make, like, a chart.
Yeah.
I probably should have, because I still ended up a little confused. Like, she talked about her parents' generation and her grandparents' generation and, you know, not just her parents and grandparents, but their siblings. And so there were a lot of names to keep track of and nicknames. And then, you know, it's interesting how she talked about her own siblings, because it was almost like two generations. Because it was like her dad had some children when her parents got married, and so did her mom. And, like, her oldest siblings were 20 years older than her. So, and so it was a lot to keep track of, to the point that I probably should have just written, like, a list of, like, who's who. Because then when she continues to talk about them later on, sometimes it was like, wait, who is that person? And yeah, sometimes she would use a nickname, and sometimes she'd use their government name.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think it is really important. And I think she, by doing that, she is saying something really important about identity. Mm-hmm. Like what you were just saying. It doesn't make sense to try to construct your identity completely detached from the generations that came before you or with you, like your siblings or, you know.
Yeah. Honoring and recognizing the labor of women, she focuses a lot on her auntie Elaine, her mom, and their mother, her grandmother, as, like, the pillars of the family, and wanted to ask which of those mother figures kind of struck you the most.
I think her mom. I feel like this is, like, an area that's really, like, people are very likely to, like, project their own, like, mom experiences.
Yeah, sure.
But I think I felt some of sort of the, I feel like she sort of gets mixed signals, right? Like, her mom seems like a very proud person and very, likes to be very neat and put together. And the things she says about how we always presented ourselves and dressed in a way where, like, no one ever knew we were poor. And that was largely due to her mom. And, like, I felt that a lot too. Like, I actually had people say that to me at some point where they were like, oh, nobody, like, no one would expect, like, where I lived, like, the part of town I lived in, or that we didn't have money because of how we dressed, because it was, like, that's something that made me comfortable.
Yeah.
And at the same time as that, I feel like people also learn this kind of shame from their moms. Mm-hmm. And I think she kind of, it's interesting because it talks about in the memoir how when her mom gets the house, how that is such a point of pride. And that you get hints of that throughout the whole thing. It is a point of pride, but then also throughout a lot of Sarah's life, it sounds like it's a big kind of source of shame. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think I related to that a lot, sort of getting a lot from your mom and really appreciating your mom as sort of the center of everything, but at the same time sort of internalizing a lot of attitudes of shame about, like, where you're from and what the conditions you're growing up in. And she talks about how they never had anyone over until her sister was in college, and after that it was like, oh, the mom's saying this house isn't comfortable for other people.
Yeah,
her mom says that
and all the time.
Yeah. And I remember my mom always saying, like, people shouldn't come over, you know. And at some point, like, when I was little, I was like, why? I just want people to come over. And then later I was like, oh, because the carpet's dirty and this is dirty and this doesn't work. And, like, you
figure it out.
Yeah, you start to, like, kind of internalize a sense of maybe, you know, maybe like the moms, of course the moms do have good reason for that, but like as much as they're like the center of your world and like you learn so much great stuff and they have so many good qualities, you also maybe are learning some of that shame. And so I think for that reason, I sort of, I'm also probably projecting, but like I feel like I related to that character,
yeah,
like to that mother figure.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's a testament to how great of a writer she is that she grew up in New Orleans. Like, she's talking about her Black family. You grew up in...
I grew up in, like, it was sort of rural-ish Michigan. My mom's from Detroit, but... And we actually lived on, like, a dirt road and stuff. But it was, like... It was, like, the carpet's too dirty, and the couch is dirty, and, like, there's clothes everywhere. There's the oven doesn't work, the... plugs are installed upside down, like everything was like, you know, like just things where you're like, oh, this isn't how a house is supposed to be. And exactly the same, like it's, this isn't comfortable for other people.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a reflection of how great a writer she is that even when you're in a different, totally different cultural context and geographic context, like you feel like she's writing about your experience.
Yeah, because that is, I mean, it is like a, right, it's a family dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just... You know, it's not just regional.
Yeah. Cool.
Which one did you like? Or like, which maternal figure did you have the most thoughts about?
I think also her mom. I thought it was interesting. So she had two husbands and both of them died. And like, Sarah talks about how she really believed that her mom thought that in her power she had killed those men.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow. Like, that's so powerful, but that also that is a bit dark.
Yeah. Like, I would think that, too, if that happened to me.
I know, right? I mean, it's just... Yeah. I mean, it is unfortunate, but then, like, she is also talking about the historical neglect that's occurred in this neighborhood. I mean, the shit that like, people live through in Katrina.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Like, reading the Katrina chapters was the hardest for me because when it happened, I was a bit young. And so since then, I've just been kind of like slowly uncovering more details of how it actually happened. And like, now I have these very graphic images in my head of like dead cats floating in water and people like running up to their attic and like standing on their roofs for days.
Yeah.
Waiting for rescue.
Yeah, I think I feel the same way because I was in high school. I remember that.
Yeah.
And it was like, you knew... what happened was terrible, but you didn't necessarily know all the, like, the details.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have any concluding thoughts?
Only I think what I was saying to you earlier, that I thought it was really interesting in this book, she says that someone suggests to her about writing a letter to her house.
Oh, yeah.
And just if anyone doesn't actually want to read the book, but I feel like I just want to share this idea because I thought it was really cool. I think it was just her friend, she said, like, had the idea that she should write a letter to her house. As an adult, I think after the house was gone. And
so the house was eventually demolished because of this, like, home program that...
Was it before that, I think?
Really?
They said it was, like, I forget what the word, but they said it
not
couldn't...
structurally sound.
Yeah, it wasn't structurally sound after the hurricane.
Oh, okay.
It was, like, an imminent danger of collapsing or...
Mm-hmm.
But someone suggested you write a letter to the house, and I just think... For me, I was like, maybe I should do that too. Like, I think there's something useful about that because, especially if you're someone who grew up in a situation in which you were kind of ashamed of where you came from or you have very specific sort of bad feelings attached to it, I think there's something to be said. Like, to me, I kind of knew that about myself, but reading this book, even more, I was like, I think there's more for me to think about there.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, to sort of, like, as an adult, be able to look back and, like, appreciate some aspects of your house, even if when you were living in it, it wasn't something that brought you joy.
Yeah. And I think, like, thinking about the physical structure of your house can be or feel like a neutral way to enter into thinking about your childhood, which is nice. So, because, like, there actually is so much there when you start to think about, like, oh, what did this room look like? What did we do in there? Like, what was this room for? And I, like, I used to not really believe that a physical structure could tell as many stories as she told.
Yeah.
And, like, she just proved me wrong. Like, no, actually, I mean, there's so much to be told from even from the perspective of a house.
And she says a lot, actually, about... There's some parts where she said that the kids and the family, like, became the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, like, a really interesting thing to think about.
Yeah. She described the house as the 13th unruly child.
Yeah, yeah. I for me, like, because in some ways I related to that, like, it gave me a lot to think about. So I would recommend reading the book.
Yeah, definitely.
Also, just knowing that maybe, even if you're not in, like, the first 50 pages, like...
Stick with it.
Yeah, stick with it, because it's, like, that's really just laying the foundation for, which is important.
Yeah.
But it's not as, like, it's not as much of a page turner, in, like, the beginning.
I guess you could skim those first pages.
Probably, yeah. You probably could.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, and hope to have you again soon.
Thanks.
Bye.